Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. We are going to switch gears here and look at some issues happening around the country nationally. There's three of them we're going to kind of focus on, which is the immigration bill that passed last night, something that came up with Edward Snowden that I want to wrestle with here and with our guests as well, something I heard this morning, and see how that fits in. And, of course, the Zimmerman trial, which we'll be spending a lot of time on later in this conversation as well, because it's one that is gripping our communities and that needs to, because it raises so many issues about race, racism, nature of the society, and more. So we'll get to all of that. In studio, we have Tony Campbell, who's president of Maryland for a Coherent and Fair Representation. Good to have you back in the studio, Tony.
Welcome. Thanks, Mark.
Arun Gupta is with us. Arun is founding editor of the Independent Magazine, and founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal, who is with us again. Arun, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Edward Wyckoff Williams, who's been covering Trayvon Martin very intensely, author, columnist, contributing editor of The Root. Welcome back, Edward.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mark.
We keep having you on so much, we might have to start paying you. I don't know.
Yes, talk to Mark Gundry about that one.
Avis Jones-DeWeaver is with us, who's host of Focus Point with Avis Jones-DeWeaver, a production of New Visions, New Voices. Avis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
So let me begin with something, Arun. You've been writing a lot about this, and I'm just going to get this piece because I heard it this morning about Edward Snowden, who we know is the man who let the world know that the NSA, National Security Administration, was spying on Americans, and that created a real uproar. And then he fled, and he ended up in Hong Kong, and then in Moscow. And we think he's still in Moscow, trying to get to Havana or Ecuador or wherever he's going. People aren't really sure just what's happening with that. But juxtapose that with where you think we are with all this and the article you wrote about another person's case, which I'm going to pull up here. One of the things that the government said this morning was that they're now accusing him of not only doing that, which was people saying exposing human rights abuses in America, they're saying he's now given information to the Chinese government that implicates American intelligence agencies spying, using cyber warfare against China. Now, if that's true, that would switch a lot of public opinion and ideas. What do you think, Arun?
We don't know, right? And given the U.S. government's track record, I don't see any reason why we should believe it. Howard Zinn once said the governments lie, and that's particularly true for the U.S. government. That's just a simple historical fact. And when we look at all these various spying programs that have just exploded over the last decade, they're constantly lying. You know, we have the two senators who are trying to warn Americans, Ron Wyden, and I forget who the other one is. You know, they're saying that the NSA is still lying, but they can't say what exactly the NSA is lying about. When they're making all these claims, so I think the burden of proof is on the government, they haven't provided any evidence in any way, shape, or form. And of course, they're going to attack Snowden because what he's doing, I think, is just an incredibly heroic public service to America and to the world to show what this government is up to and how it's a rogue government.
And the other part I want you to talk to them, although I think I kind of waxed on this a bit, but you wrote a piece in The Guardian about how we all know about Edward Snowden and we all know about Bradley Manning, most Americans do, who are following the news, but we don't know about Barrett Brown.
Right.
And this is even scarier in some ways than either one of these, in terms of what he's facing and what he did.
Yeah. I think, especially because we were talking about the Trayvon Martin trial, it's quite interesting because Barrett Brown and Trayvon, there's a parallel between them in terms of noble victims, right? And neither of them are considered noble victims. You know, the George Zimmerman trial is really the Trayvon Martin trial. That's who's being put on trial, even though he was the one who was murdered. This is about his character. You know, if we thought that Trayvon was a noble victim, this would be an open and shut case. Zimmerman would have been thrown in jail a long time ago. Similarly with Barrett Brown, he helped to uncover basically corporations that are engaged in nefarious spying activity, and not just spying, trying to infiltrate and disrupt. And it's a bit of a complicated case, as these intrigues are, but it essentially involves Bank of America retained a law firm that retained these private intelligence contractors, these companies, which put together a plan to try and destroy WikiLeaks, which involved feeding false information, and also to silence journalists like Glenn Greenwald. He was also involved in helping us publicize the Stratfor leaks. That's the private intelligence firm in which 5 million emails of it were hacked. And the guy who did the hacking, Jeremy Hammond, he just pled guilty because and is going to be in jail for 20 years. Now, in Baird Brown's case, he's a journalist. And he's no angel, but so what? None of us are. And he was a journalist engaged in doing journalism, and the government in the Stratfor case, he basically pasted a link, and that link was full of a data dump from Stratfor, and in that data dump were 5,000 credit cards, and the U.S. has hit him with a total of 17 charges, 3 separate indictments. He's been sitting in jail since last September in a jail outside of Dallas, Texas, facing 105 years in prison, because among the charges they're saying that he was trying to steal these credit card numbers with the intent to defraud. And this is ridiculous. He just pasted a link. And many other journalists have pointed out if Baird Brown is guilty, so are they. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people were pasting that same link. And yet the company that were engaging in this plan to try and destroy WikiLeaks, to try and shut down these journalists, they had the appearance of engaging in all sorts of criminal activity. And in fact, 17 House Democrats signed a letter citing various federal laws that appeared that they had broken, saying they should be prosecuted, and nothing was ever done.
So let me get our guest to comment on this part of our conversation then before we move on to something else. And Edward Wyckoff Jones, this has not been your kind of bailiwick, but I'm just curious as to your thoughts on with the whole question of security and our insecurity of the future here.
I would like to respond. I wanted to say that I completely agreed with him on the point that he made about this being Trayvon Martin's murder trial as opposed to George Zimmerman's. I thought that was brilliant insight. But I respectfully disagree with many of the points made about Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, because I think that, first of all, Edward Snowden was contracted and had an obligation to respect and protect the information that he had access to. I think that the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee was right when he said that we have a process for whistleblowers, and we interview whistleblowers all the time and do as much as we can to protect them. Edward Snowden was fully aware of that process and decided to do what he's doing. I also think that there's a double standard here for people like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden who look the way that they do, because I think that if they were brown Arab Americans who were Muslim, then they would have been caught by Navy SEALs by now. They would have been kidnapped in the middle of the night, and we probably wouldn't know what black site they were at. And I think that there's an arrogance with people like Glenn Greenwald, who, yes, I think is engaged in respectful journalism for the most part, but there's something really twisted about him being able to go to China with Edward Snowden, interview him in that way, because it seems like he is colluding with this, and I think that there's something sinister about that, and I think that there is a process for that to be discussed in open debate, but also I think there's a legal process that the Justice Department has every right to pursue. So I'm not on the bandwagon that these are details the American people need to know, partly because we already knew about this. USA Today reported on this in 2006. This is a pre-Obama program. Not only that, the NSA sat in front of the House in the 1970s, and you had congressmen then questioning whether or not they were collecting phone data on American citizens. That was four decades ago. So this idea that he's doing the country a service and that he's some kind of hero, I think is completely ludicrous.
All right, we'll let the other guests come back, and Aaron come back to respond. The other guests wait on this. We've come back from this very brief break and move on to questions of immigration and the Zimmerman trial. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner with our National Roundtable, looking at the news of the day and see what's going on. The three topics we're covering this next 45 minutes or so. We have with us Tony Campbell, who's president of Marylanders for Coherent and Fair Representation, Aaron Gupta, founding editor of Independent Magazine, founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal, Avis Jones-DeWeaver, host of Focus Point, with Avis Jones-DeWeaver, a production of New Visions and New Voices, and Edward Wyckoff Williams, of course, author, columnist, and contributing editor of To the Root. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Come to these phone calls in just a minute. Let's go to our two guests and get their feedback, and we'll get to Aaron before we move back on. Avis, what's your take on this?
Well, you know, I tend to agree that with Snowden, of course, what he divulged is something that we knew, but it is good that the public knows more about it and is more engaged in this. However, it is unsavory, in my opinion, that he has sort of flown the coop in this way, bouncing around from country to country under the guise of wanting to be more more outgoing in terms of freedom of the press. But the countries that he finds himself finding refuge in are not exactly bastions of freedom of the press. It's something that's very unsavory to me about that. And so I do agree that it is important to know what we are doing in this nation and sort of have these critical discussions around the degree to which civil liberties are at stake in this nation when we try to pretend to be a country that is, in fact, one that is very much in favor of broad civil liberties. But how do we balance that with the need to protect ourselves from threats from outside? That's a discussion that we need to have, but we need to have it in a way that is very upfront, that is very honest, and not sort of hidden behind the cloak of making these statements, but then running behind other nations that are not exactly nations that are known for being very very good in terms of their civil liberty records.
Tony,
we've been having that conversation since after 9/11. You know, when the Patriot Act went through the Congress and the decision was between, do we want safety or do we want freedom? Do we want to make sure that we're safe in our homes and government's being big brother and watching over us? Or do we take our chances and let things happen? Well, we chose the Patriot Act. And to think that the NSA and other agencies hasn't been spying on the American population since that moment is ridiculous. It's ludicrous. But even more interesting enough is that this is not just coming from Mr. Snowden. You know, this morning, a former vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff leaked information. You know, and even more interesting enough, I just find the disparity of response is deafening. That, you know, if this was George W. Bush that was attacking journalists, going after their phone records, having NSA, doing this overarching spying on the American people, if this was George W. Bush, there would be marches in the streets. This has been Barack Obama who's carried on this on these programs and these policies.
But you're acting like he started the program. The program.
But he hasn't stopped the program.
Has he
stopped it? But has he stopped it?
That's an excuse. Just because
he's the president of the United States.
Illegal program. We should ignore that fact.
That's not the point that I'm making.
Has declared a war on whistleblowers. It has prosecuted three times as many whistleblowers as in the entire U.S. history, and it has declared a war on journalists.
And that's a fair point. Is this Barack Obama's fault? Let me just one at a time.
Aaron, finish your point quickly, and let me go over and see what Edward is saying. Come back to Tony and Avis.
Maybe Edward Snowden had something to fear, that Bradley Manning has been in jail for 3 years and was being tortured by the U.S. government, the conditions that he was under for well over a year until a campaign, an international campaign, forced the Obama administration to stop torturing him. Okay, we are dealing with a criminal government here, and to go on spouting these pieties is ridiculous, especially from journalists who should be protecting sources and should be acknowledging. Maybe you don't like what they're saying, but it's in your self-interest to protect other journalists like Glenn Greenwald.
And you were saying, to counter that, Edward, what?
I was taking issue. I wasn't even going to where he's going with respect to Bradley Manning. I'm not quite sure what's the difference between what happens to the Muslims in Guantanamo Bay and what happened to Bradley Manning. At the end of the day, it's an investigation.
Oh,
to figure
so
out
great. That justifies it. Let's torture everyone.
And I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that it seems like when it's a Bradley Manning or an Edward Snowden, everybody's up in arms. But when it's happening every day to Muslim Americans, then nobody cares. So I think that there's something problematic
about that.
Oh, I care.
There are plenty of people who care that
but
they're being tortured
too. But I was taking issue specifically with what you said about if this had been under Bush, then, quote-unquote, I guess your point was liberals would be in the streets. And that's actually not true because they were not in 2006 when this was first reported. And so this idea of trying to all – because liberals – particularly on the far left, are starting to do the same thing that the far right is doing, which is blame Barack Obama for every ill and malaise in this country. And I think that's what's problematic about this. Yes, let's have a discussion. Yes, let's be critical. But let's not act like the American government and the apparatus in which it operates has existed long before this president.
So let me go, and that's exactly how I opened my statement. Is that this government has been doing this, especially as far as the – your cell phone conversations are not private. You have no right to privacy in this government, especially after 9/11. So, you know, just to think that – I guess my point was all the Occupy Wall Street folks and everything that was happening when Bush was in two wars that – okay, we can argue whether they were justified or not, but they were marching in the streets because of that. And they were marching in the streets for everything that they considered that what George W. Bush was doing was wrong. Barack Obama is doing a lot of the same stuff. Where is the marches in the streets over this? Where are the liberals, Democrats that were on CNN, on MSNBC, talking about the president all the time, every day, ad infinitum? And then there's just this silence that's deafening.
That's actually not happening. All you have to do is turn on MSNBC, and you'll see a lot of liberal journalists attacking President Obama the same way that it seems a lot of people on this conversation are doing. So I don't. And if anything, I think Barack Obama has attempted to be more.
Well, one at a time, Tony Campbell. Let me just be clear: as a Republican, so.
But. I think that if anything, Barack Obama has attempted to be to provide more information. You know, to be more honest. But
this whole thing has been about dishonesty.
So let me get all the guests in here for a moment. Aaron and Avis, let me let you jump in. Then Aaron, please, Avis.
Well, you know, the reality is we do have to come to some recognition that as a nation, there are things that are classified, there are things that are unclassified. Yeah. We cannot have a society where every person knows about everything that we do in the intelligence community as a nation. That is just an impractical assumption. Now, of course, there are things that have gone on, particularly in the post 9/11 era, that are more than disturbing. And I happen to agree with the point that if Snowden looked a little different, if his last name had an Arabic slant, this would go in a completely different direction. In fact, I would argue that no one other than a white man could get a $200,000 job doing what he was doing with the GED and the background that he had.
Thank you.
So let's just be very real about that. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that there are things that this public as a group, we cannot know everything that our government is engaged in as it relates to the intelligence community. That's why it's called intelligence. Now, when things happen in which we go a little bit too far, and we do find out about it, then maybe we should raise questions and then say, well, have we gone too far? Have we not gone too far? But to expect that we would know everything that this government engages in the name of intelligence, in the name of trying to keep us safe, I think it's just unrealistic.
So, Aaron?
Well, I would also remind our listeners that this government is basically one large criminal enterprise, right? Under our great and hallowed leader Barack Obama, he's essentially extended the war on terror to twice as many countries as the Bush administration. The Bush administration never asserted the right to extrajudicial assassination of U.S. citizens. The fact is that the whole national security excuse has been used for hundreds of years. I mean, this goes back to the Alien and Sedition Act of the late 18th century, you know, that there's always this excuse of national security. And really, it's about repressing the domestic population and basically carrying out foreign policy for the interests of both the military and large corporate enterprises.
Well, do you believe that there is no need for classified information? Is that the argument that you're making?
I don't think anyone in the world should trust the U.S. anything the U.S. government has to say. We've killed millions of people in illegal wars over the last 70 years. Okay, we are fighting. At one point in 2012, we were bombing seven separate countries. If someone had drones flying over our skies killing civilians, I think there would be just a little bit of outrage. Why should we be any less outraged that we're blowing apart women, children, and civilians in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Yemen, all these countries, Somalia, Iraq, all these countries, none of whom we have declared war against, and none of whom have done anything to us? Why do we have had hundreds, perhaps even thousands of drone strikes on civilians in Pakistan under Barack Obama? He's a war criminal. That's what the reality is. If any other government in the world was doing what he was doing, there would be calls for him to be before the International Court of Justice, or rather for the SEALs to come in and grab him and take him to some black site.
So I want to close out this topic, and Edward, I'll let you have kind of a final thought here before we move on to our next subject.
I don't actually have a final thought.
Okay.
I'm good.
So let's move on. I do want to kind of get to immigration here, but I don't want to pass the opportunity for us to kind of comment on what's been going on and kind of gripping much of the nation. And I would say in some ways gripping the African-American communities more than the nation as a whole, which is also a problem, which is the trial of George Zimmerman and why it's so important. And I know that Edward Wyckoff Williams and I have been on the air about this a great deal together. But let me begin this conversation, because I think that to get some thoughts from all of you about what all this means, and I want to hear the testimony from Rachel Gentel. Now, I'm not sure which clip this is yet, because it's not in front of me, but I apologize for that to my listeners. But she's a young woman who testified at the trial. She's the last person to hear. To talk to Trayvon Martin before he was murdered. And she's gotten a lot of criticism. The social media has exploded with attacks on this young woman. And because of the way she speaks, where she comes from, and the confrontation between her and, I almost said the white prosecutor, but the white defense attorney. And so let's play. Are we playing the clip about the funerals that we're going to first? Let's play that.
The funeral, why I go to the viewing? Mm-hmm. I didn't want to see the body. Mm-hmm. I did agree with my friends that I was going to go. You got to understand.
In order...
You got to understand.
Mm-hmm. Did
you the last person to talk to the person, mm-hmm. and he died on the phone. After you talk to him, you got to understand what I'm trying to tell you. I'm the last person. You don't know how I felt. You think I really want to go see the body after I just talked to him?
So that and we've heard a lot about this testimony, the battle of this testimony. We're going to hear that clip in a moment. But I think that before I come to what I think about how this trial may be defining America in some ways that I wrote to Edward Wyckoff William about last night, Avis Jones DeWeaver, I don't know if you've written about this particular incident. I have not read it. If you had, I apologize. But give me your thoughts on this.
You know, what's going on in terms of the complete sort of degradation of this young woman on social media really lets us see how far we still have to go in terms of cleavages of race, class, and gender in this nation. What we are witnessing as we're witnessing her testimony in this trial are really the divergence of two very different cultures, two very different backgrounds, two very different generations, quite frankly. And she is still a child. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's getting lost in all of these critiques. She is still a child. She is not a mature, seasoned woman with a great deal of life experience, with the best of circumstances. She is a child that went through an extremely traumatic situation. How many of us could imagine what it must have been like to know that you are talking to your friend 1 minute, and the next minute, the person you just spoke to is shot dead cold-bloodedly? How is she processing that? How is she dealing with that? And so the degree to which she is being just relentlessly attacked in social media without taking into consideration that broader context, to me, is extremely disturbing and shows that we still have a long way to go in this nation when it comes to really cutting across those boundaries of difference that we still have a hard time navigating, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ed.
First of all, that was brilliant. I think that there's so much here because it was very emotional for me to actually watch her. I am, like, that is my family. You know, these are that girl reminds me of one of my closest cousins. And I, yes, went to Yale, went to law school, went to Oxford, but I speak that girl's language. And there's something really problematic about the way that she has been portrayed or misunderstood, and then therefore everything about her misconstrued, because it just speaks to how far we have not yet come. So there are a couple of things. I think there's one, she's from the South. She's probably from not such an educated family and, you know, speaks the way that she does, but she makes perfect sense. And what I do love is that despite being grilled by the defense attorney and him shrewdly thinking that he was manipulating her, she stuck to her story. And it was extremely clear that this man came up behind this boy. He felt he kept watching him. He was followed. And then he turned to him and said, "Why are you following me?" Next thing she knows, there's a fight that ensues, and then her friend is dead. And so even when they're trying to use the fact that she lied about where she was on the day of the funeral because she could not bear to go to see that body and stand in front of that grieving mother, I think most of us completely empathize and sympathize with that. We understand that. I've been in that situation before. I've not gone to funerals because I could not bear it. And I think also the fact that she has been attacked on social media shows why she never wanted to be a public figure to begin with. Because when she said that she let them believe that she was 16 because she knew that that would protect her identity, speaks to why she would have never wanted to be in this situation to begin with. So I think it's disgusting that anyone would be talking about her in any negative ways. And I think that what she just what Avis just said speaks to where we still have not come with respect to gender as well, but also race and also class.
Tony, do you have thoughts on this before we hit another clip?
Yeah. Well, first of all, racism still exists. So let's be clear about that. We may be in 2013. We're transcendent. Our society's beyond us, but we're really not. But I think even more profound is the disparity of the system itself, that this is a systematic problem, that, you know, we still have large communities in our country, especially African Americans, that still do not have the same resources or access to resources as other folks do. And that was definitely apparent in the clip. My takeaway from this is that it's amazing that this hasn't happened more often. It's a tragedy, but the fact that, you know, these incidents 50, 40, 50, 60 years ago were commonplace. We've moved that far. that these kinds of actions that are racially motivated don't happen nearly as much as it did, you know, decades ago. You know, even looking at, you know, back in the 1990s, as soon as the 1990s, I'm not using the right word here, but, you know, the Rodney King incident in L.A., huge riots afterwards. The fact that we as a community, even though we're on different sides of this issue, whether it's, you know, a trial against Trayvon Martin or a trial against George Zimmerman, that community came together and didn't pull apart, didn't riot at the seams, didn't go and attack each other, says a lot that we have come a long way. Because if this was the 1960s or even the 1970s, this would have blown up.
Well, and we'll see what happens after this trial is over. We hope everything stays calm, and especially if he's found not guilty.
Right.
Aaron, do you have a thought? I want to play another clip here. Do you have another thought on this?
I think this it certainly is both about race and class and gender issues. She doesn't look the correct way, but I would also say, you know, she's a child, but she is also an adult. She was able to hold her own against the defense attorney, and you know, certainly her she's also on trial in a way, and her intelligence is being attacked. And you know, I think it's certainly not surprising that she's being attacked both by those within the white community and unfortunately those within the black community, people who feel that they're embarrassed by her. But she's also someone who's trilingual, and in that way she's much smarter than the average American. Yeah.
So let me play this other clip that goes to this point, and I'll raise some of the issues about some of the things I've been reading. There's another clip from the conversation with Rachel.
Ms. Gentile, you were born and raised in Miami, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you spoke English at home?
What age you're talking about, sir?
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Are you saying that English is your third language? That you spoke Creole and Spanish first?
I spoke three languages first. I learned how to speak three languages first, but Creole was the first one.
Does your mother speak English?
Not that well, sir.
Does she speak English?
Not that well, sir.
I understand she may have an accent or some limitations, but do you speak to her in English?
Sometimes, sir.
And if you're not speaking to her in English, you're speaking to her in Creole?
Yes, sir.
And your father, do you speak to him in English?
Yes, sir.
And when you went to school as a child, kindergarten, did you speak English at school?
Yes, sir.
And have you spoken English to your teachers and classmates in school up through today?
Yes, sir.
Are you claiming in any way that you don't understand English?
I understand you. I understand you. I do understand English.
My question is, when someone speaks to you in English, do you believe that you have any difficulty understanding it because it wasn't your first language?
I understand English really well.
You've spoken it all your life?
Yes, sir.
And there's nothing that I've said to you today in English that, or yesterday, that you haven't understood, correct?
No, sir.
It's disgusting.
Jerk.
Honestly, it's so disgusting. It feels like we have been transported back to, you know, 1865. But I'm so glad, like one of your guests just made the point, I'm sorry, this girl is bilingual and therefore far beyond like anything that he's trying to twist and turn. But the strategy there is twofold. Because essentially what they want to do from a legal perspective is to claim that what she says she heard in terms of the conversation between Trayvon and George Zimmerman, perhaps she didn't fully hear.
Right.
And that's to plant a seed of doubt in the minds of the jury. So this is actually just court drama and just the way that the legal system works. And to that end, I can't necessarily attack them ad hominem. But they also know that they're playing into old racial codes in this country, and I think that that's what's disgusting about it.
Absolutely. Avis Jones-DeWeaver?
Yeah, unfortunately, I couldn't hear the clip, but
I
definitely get where this is. That's okay. I definitely get where this is going, and I certainly understand the context of those comments. And I would just say then, that then ties into who's on the jury, right? And so if we have a jury that is made up of five white women and one Latina, is there anybody on that jury who is bilingual in the same way that this young woman is? And therefore, are they more likely then to be more sympathetic to the defense's characterization of her, of her stances than they are to really understand really where she's going and why she is, to really have sort of a cultural grounding in where she's coming from and an understanding of exactly her perspective on the issues? That's what's concerning of me. I wish, you know, if there was at least one African-American juror, for example,
right,
that could have sort of decode this when they go back to sort of deliberate around this issue, I would feel a lot more confident. But knowing the makeup of that jury, it makes me sort of wary of how her testimony will be internalized and then critiqued once they go back and engage in deliberations and then try to determine whether or not they think that she's a truthful person.
We had, when the very beginning of the week, I think, I'm not sure if Edward joined this conversation or not when we had it, but when we were talking about the jury selection, one of the things that one of the attorneys, Doug Colbert, said in this room, he's a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, who works a lot in our jail system to get people out who are being incarcerated for small crimes, that they should be out in the street, not in prison. At any rate, what he said was that it always makes a difference when someone who is African-American on trial to have an African-American juror on the trial. At least two of these jurors, he said, should have been African-American. There was no reason for that not to happen, because in trials like this, when these things do occur, as you were just describing, Avis, the African-American members of that jury play a critical role in the interaction between all the jurors. And I think that this is that's something, this kind of the kind of prejudicial mind I want to talk about when we come back from break for a moment before we hit another topic, because I was reflecting on the polls that came out about this trial. And what the polls say to me, maybe they don't say the same things to the four of you, but I'm going to lay them out and see what you do think when we come back from this brief break. Do you have a thought to take us to break, Tony, before we...
No, not really. I mean, I echo what everyone else has said, but I do think the juror selection was very interesting. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with these six women, because I was doing something yesterday, and I was going, I think it was one of the cable news networks, and they had their legal expert on, as all of them have one. And the lady said that, you know, these six women, you know, they may be actually harder on her than if they were males. Maybe they won't be as sympathetic with as far as that's concerned. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
We're going to take a very brief break. Don't go away. Continue this conversation. Try to hit another subject before we meet our friends from Iceland. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Avis Jones-DeWeaver, host of Focus Point with Avis Jones-DeWeaver, a production of New Visions, New Voices. Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor to The Root, author, columnist, Arun Gupta. Arun Gupta is founding editor of The Independent Magazine, founding editor of Occupy Wall Street Journal, Tony Campbell, president of Marylanders for Coherent and Fair Representation, Inc. 410-319-8888. Let's go to that. We played the clip about English. So let me just raise this issue here. One of the polls that I saw, and I've been following some of these polls, and they say a lot to me about where we are in America today. And this is not setting up a situation where I'm saying that because Barack Obama's African American and this number of white people voted for Barack Obama, and Democrats are here and Republicans are here. It says something much deeper than anything to do with Republicans or Democrats. It says something about America. Where 38% of white Americans in these polls have said that they think that Zimmerman murdered Trayvon Martin, and he should be convicted. There should be no question about what's going on here. There is a body almost equal in number that said that Zimmerman is innocent. He was defending himself. He should be a free man. A body a little smaller, but in the 30 percentiles, that is saying that white Americans saying, we don't know, we can't answer the question, because we have to see all the facts before we're going to say that Zimmerman is guilty. To me, this goes kind of to the heart of the question we just saw with this jury, what they're hearing from the woman, young woman who just testified, whose voice we just heard, because it goes to the heart of kind of the subtleness of this unconscious racism in America, how this plays into this trial. People want to kind of set it up as white people and black people think differently about the trial, but it's deeper than that. And I think that's what we're afraid to wrestle with. I hope that we can make a conversation in America about this to begin to change the kind of nature of how we think, maybe probe it a little deeper to get under it, because that's what I think we're afraid to get to here, because we're going to come this down, all black people think you should be guilty and white people don't, because Edward Wyckoff Williams, it's a much deeper question than that.
Yeah, it is. Mark, I wrote a piece last year at the height of the media attention on this case, called Racism Without Racist, and the George Zimmerman and the Conundrum of Modern Bigotry. Because I think that when you look at those polls, that's what you're seeing. I'm actually really encouraged by the fact that 38% of whites thought that
he belonged
behind bars.
I am, too.
I think that's really encouraging.
Yep.
And I would even go as far, Mark, as to say that other 30% that said they need to know the facts before they convict him with their minds and hearts isn't necessarily a bad thing, partly because this trial hasn't gotten the same kind of attention from whites as it has from blacks. So black people are emotionally invested in this,
yes,
because of our history, right? But there are lots of white people who are just living their lives, who have heard about the story, but they hear about people being killed every day, and they're not quite sure what makes this particular situation special. And until they do become involved, do actually figure out the fact that this was a skinny 17-year-old kid with Skittles walking home to watch basketball, and that this grown man with a gun was following him and taunting him in the dark, until they actually would even engage with the details of this case, would they perhaps then join that 38%? And so I'm not going to make any assumptions about what they know and how deeply they are involved, because obviously this is something quite passionate for us, but I don't expect that everybody is supposed to feel the same way. But to that end, I do think that this goes back to what you and I and attorney Benjamin Crump, the family attorney for Trayvon Martin's family, were saying, that there's something insidious about the fact that in this society, black children, black victims, and black male victims in particular, are never given the deference of being an innocent victim. They're always seen as suspicious in their own demise. They're always seen as an agent of their own demise, and we've seen that happening in this case, as one of your guests said, you know, that this is really Trayvon Martin on trial. This is Rachel John Teal on trial, when these are the victims in this case. And so I think that until the broader society begins to see black child victims in the same way that they see white child victims, we will continue to see polls that break down in that way.
I completely agree. And I have to say that, you know, how people's perceptions are shaped around this issue is not only buttressed by our history collectively as a nation, it's buttressed by our own personal experiences. I am the mother of a 17-year-old black male child, and I have watched him grow up over 17 years. And I have seen him as a small child, cute and adorable, beautiful, infectious smile, stopping people on the street of all races that want to just engage in him because he's so sweet and adoring. And I've seen him grow over the years with that same personality on the inside,
mm-hmm.
but now outside he's over 6 feet. You know, now on the outside he has an athletic build. Now on the outside, those same individuals who may have stopped him when he was two or three just to play with him are now crossing the street to get away from him. And so that's the real reality. This past weekend, I mean, this is no joke, this past weekend, my son was being dropped off at his father's house by his friend, and they were stopped in his father's driveway by a policeman who said they looked suspicious. He had to prove that he lived there. This is not something that happened 50 years ago. This is not something that's a collective aberration that black people make up to say that, you know, we are somehow unfairly victimized. This is reality. And I shudder to think what could have happened to my son, and I would have never known the truth about it. This is a reality that as African Americans, we still deal with day to day. No, it's not as bad and as horrendous and as often as it was a few decades ago, but it's real. And if you're a young black child navigating this society, your life is still in danger when you're going about your way, doing everyday things in a way that most of us don't even think about.
Arun Gupta, let me get a thought.
Yeah.
And then
I think so technically George Zimmerman is on trial. In reality, it's Trayvon Martin and by association, Rachel Jean Teller on trial. But what we really need on trial here is racial profiling and our criminal justice system, which in the words of Michelle Alexander is the new Jim Crow. What is it that allows Zimmerman to be able to do what he did? It's that we have systematically criminalized black youth, especially young black men. I live in New York City, and this is not just about unconscious racism, it's very much about conscious racism. You have the largest police force in the country that is fighting tooth and nail to essentially keep in place a racist policing system. The NYPD, until it finally, under tremendous pressure from the courts and the public, after nearly 20 years of organizing, and started to roll back its stop and frisk policy. But before it did, it was stopping, and this is its own records, which it's been forced to collect over 10 years, and there's strong suspicion that it's doctoring these records. So by the NYPD's own admitted record, it in 2011 stopped more young black men in New York City than there are young black men in New York City. And that's because the cops are going out, and you talk to these guys in the neighborhood, and some of them have been stopped 20 times, stopped the first 10 times, 20 times, and a lot of them are school children. So why is it that in this country we can have a child, Trayvon was a child, who is seen as a criminal in his own neighborhood, and a lot of people accept that he is a criminal? I don't want to say things are certainly not as bad as they were a century ago, but there's still deep racism, and we need to think of the hundreds of thousands of young black men who have been shunted into the criminal justice system, their lives destroyed. They may be still alive, but their lives have been destroyed by this racist criminal justice system, and that's what needs to be on trial.
So, Tony, very quick thought. We're almost out of time. I'm sorry.
Well, the perception has always existed. I'm 47 years old, and throughout my entire life, I've had to be careful about where I am, what I'm doing, who's seeing me doing what, and everything else, because I am an African American male. So that hasn't changed. I think the poll does show something that's very, very heartening, though, is that over almost 70% of Caucasian people, at least, either believe that Zimmerman should be in jail, or that they have an open mind to actually find out what is going on and let the process play out.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us. I apologize. I did not check my screen off enough. I didn't get to the phones, but I wanted to do this last segment. But we do have to take a break here. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. Tony Campbell, always good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Arun Gupta, thank you so much for the work you're doing and what you've been writing. I appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Edward Wyckoff-Williams, always great to have you on the show, my friend.
Absolute pleasure.
And Avis Jones-DeWeaver, first time, please come back.
I certainly will. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you all with us. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to meet some musicians here from Iceland. Don't go away.